Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Soho Forum. My name is Lucas Grund, and I help produce this debate series. I want to thank you all for coming to tonight's debate featuring Melanie Thompson and Caitlin Bailey. Tonight's debate resolution reads, paying for sex should be a crime. This is an Oxford-style debate, and you, the audience, will participate by voting on the resolution. You will vote yes, no, or undecided. You will also vote twice. You'll vote once prior to the debate and once again following the debate. The person who moves the vote more in their favor wins. You must vote both times for your vote to count. So you can lock in your initial vote now by going to sohovote.com. You can use the Sheen Center Wi-Fi information displayed on the screen behind me. And initial voting will close once the debate begins, and it will not reopen until the conclusion of the debate. Thank you again for coming to tonight's debate. And to moderate the debate tonight is the director of the Soho Forum, Gene Epstein.
Thank you. Thank you, Lucas. And welcome again. The resolution reads, paying for sex should be a crime. We have a special program, a computerized program, that will only recognize your vote if you vote both times. If you vote the first time but not the second, you won't be counted. If you vote the second time but not the first, you won't be counted. So do please vote yes, no, or undecided on the resolution. And as some of you might know, that comes from what a style of voting originated at the Oxford University debates, known as Oxford style voting. Welcome to the first month of the 10th year of our Soho Forum. The very first debate was held in Soho, in fact, in that case. Very first debate was held in September of 2016. So we begin our 10th year. And the Soho Forum has been a labor of love for me right from the start and continues to be, with the exception of those 11 months during the lockdowns in New York when I had to do the debates on Zoom. As soon as the lockdowns were lifted, we reverted to doing it in front of live audiences, even though at that point we were subject to the rules and regs having to do with masks and vaccination proof and all that other things. But I have always felt that I've wanted to do debates before a live audience. That's the sort of debate that I find most exciting and most energizing. And on top of that, the other mark of a Soho Forum debate is that it is always one versus one, not two versus two, so that both sides get plenty of time to present their arguments. We would not have been launched because I'm one of the worst fundraisers imaginable, but I did luckily know Don Smith, late lamented Don Smith, a dear friend, who launched me, gave me enough money for the first 4 months of our Soho Forum. We were drawing enough crowds so that he continued his donations, and now we have one other principal donor who keeps us going. The ticket sales also help defray our costs, but they're clearly not nearly enough to do all that we do to bring people in, sometimes from as far as London, to come and debate, and fees and all the rest of it cost us a lot. And so we are especially grateful to our donors and to the Smith Family Foundation in particular for launching us. And then after a few months of the Smith Family Foundation managing us, I got connected with the Reason Foundation and decided I could avoid having to create a nonprofit of my own and just do it my way, and then have and then get the Reason Foundation to consent to managing us for no fee. They manage our money. They publish our debates on the Reason Channel. They do all that for us just out of their own goodwill, and so we're especially grateful to them for that as well. And here to say a few words, Reason Editor-at-Large, Nick Gillespie.
Hi, everybody. Reason Foundation is proud to be Gene and the Soho Forum's Shabbos Goy when it comes to fundraising and putting videos up and things like that. There are copies of Reason Magazine floating around. Please take a look at it. This is a great issue that showcases our attitude or our beliefs in free minds and free markets making the world a better place. The cover story explains why Europe, over the past 30 years or so, the European Union has fallen behind economically and kind of culturally from America, why Europeans have less. There's a wonderful piece in here by Fiona Harrigan about how American universities are still the magnet for the best students from all over the world, but our policy, current policies, threaten to kind of reverse that magnet and screw up what has been a general, really great pipeline of talent and innovation and new thinking and new ideas into the country. And I'll also point out there's an interview that I did some months ago with Richard Dawkins, the atheist and biologist, that's just, it's a great way of the way that we think about giving individuals more choices over more parts of their lives makes for a better world. Please take the issue, share it with people you like. But mostly, Reason is proud to partner with the Smith Family Foundation to host the Soho Forum, because what Gene has built here is a place for civic discourse and debate over the most important issues of the day. You know, just a week ago, we witnessed a disgusting, vile, horrific, illiberal act of political violence in this country, and it's up to all of us to keep coming out and keep debating tough issues, hard issues, issues that separate us in full view, and refusing to shut down or retreat or, you know, not talk about the things that matter most to us, even when they are divisive. And this is something that the Soho Forum has been doing for the better part of a decade and promises to keep doing it. So, Gene, thank you very much for everything you're doing here, and we look forward to celebrating the 20th anniversary and the 30th and 40th anniversary of the Soho Forum with all of you here, too. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Nick. I want to remind many of you who've been coming to the Soho Forum that we do have a twofold mission, not just to have stimulating debates that we hope are of interest to the larger community as well as to libertarians, but also to build a community with an after party. And per usual, the after party will be held two blocks uptown at the loft apartment I share with my wife. She caters it. If you've bought a ticket to the after party, do please come. I used to invite almost everybody and tell them to donate in the morning, but there have been a lot of protests that the crowds at the after party have gotten to be a little bit too much. Reminds me of the Yogi Berra joke, nobody goes there anymore, it's too crowded. Well, it was too crowded, and we want only those who have bought tickets to come to the party. A significant number of you have done so, and I believe both debaters, that doesn't always happen, but both debaters will be at the party so that the dialogue can continue. Now for the main event, paying for sex should be a crime. Defending the resolution, Melanie Thompson. Melanie, please come to the stage. Opposing the resolution, Caitlin Bailey. Caitlin, please come to the stage. Melanie, you have 15 minutes to defend the resolution. I think you'd like to take the podium, so take it away, Melanie.
All righty. Good evening, everyone. My name, as you've heard, is Melanie Thompson, and before I get into everything, I want to extend a thank you to Jean and the Soho Forum for inviting me to take part in this debate, the Sheen Center for hosting, and to my opponent, Caitlin, for engaging in this discussion with me. I am glad to see you again and excited to see where this evening will take us. And most of all, thanks to everyone here in the audience and online for being here on a Monday night to listen to us. So, a little bit about me, for those of you who don't know. I was kidnapped and sex trafficked as a child and have experienced some of the most unimaginable things. But I have also spent the last 16 years as an advocate for human rights and the rights of survivors all across the globe. And during this time, I have made it my life's work, my mission, if you will, to unsettle people, whether that person is a state lawmaker or a congressperson or even just my neighbor. I try to get people to see that the systems that are currently in place fundamentally keep our society unequal and challenge people to consider that just because something is normalized, like prostitution, like paying for sex, doesn't mean that it's acceptable. Tonight, as Jean mentioned, I will defend the resolution, paying for sex should be a crime. And in fact, here in the United States, in every corner except for a few counties in Nevada, paying for sex is a crime. But in reality, the buyers overwhelmingly get away with it, legally, socially, and culturally. I consider my task tonight to be bigger than just simply explaining why paying for sex should be a crime, because to understand the why, you'd have to understand that this issue is not about knee-jerk morality or a desire to police what goes on in people's private lives or in their bedrooms. It's about human rights, mutuality, and undoing a racist, sexist, and classist system. I personally believe that the role of government is to provide social safety nets and enforce legislation that protects our human rights, which include the right to not be exploited and to have authentic autonomy over one's own body and sexuality. Now, you may not agree with me, but tonight we are not debating broader political theory or the reach of government. The lives of real people are affected when actions are either criminalized or decriminalized. Now, if the government were to say buying sex is okay and it's decriminalized, then that would unleash market forces, similar to how we've seen the market for marijuana explode here in New York. But women, young people, LGBTQ plus people, we are not products. You can, you know, grow an ethical joint in your backyard, but you cannot grow a person. You find them on the margins of society in places where they've had an absence of choice. I want to be clear about the topic at hand tonight. When we talk about paying for sex, we are not talking about the sex itself. We are talking about who the sex is from, and more importantly, who is purchasing it. It's a predatory economy ruled by the customer or the buyer, and in which the seller or the worker, as Caitlin would say, has little to no power. But people in prostitution are not working. They are not engaging in a free economy. This is a system of exploitation that targets the most marginalized individuals and prohibits these individuals from having full access to life, liberty, and property. This reality requires us to recognize that some degree of government involvement is necessary in order to protect the rights of individuals to dignity, to decent work, and to not be bought and sold. So given that this is a libertarian debate forum, I imagine that most of you in the audience agree that the government has no right to interfere in transactions between consenting adults because of your belief in individual freedoms and a free market. Personal autonomy is key in this vision of the world. So what I'd like to focus on here is exactly that. If we're talking about personal autonomy, we have to not only consider that of the buyer, but also the autonomy of the person being bought. So let me ask, are the majority of prostituted people able to truly consent to being bought and sold in this marketplace? I think that most of us would agree that a situation in which consent is only given due to external pressures does not actually equate to true consent. And what pressures am I talking about, you might ask? the need for money in order to survive or to feed your family, to feed a substance abuse disorder, because you love your boyfriend and he's telling you to sleep with his friends for money, because your foster parents started selling you at 14 and now you know nothing else. Caitlin and others might say, oh yeah, that's terrible. We want to help those people get out. But those people make up the vast majority of people in the sex trade. And what's the best way to help all of them? By decriminalizing paying for sex so buyers can take advantage of these pressures with more frequency? You see, most of the time, the narratives that we hear, the sex work is work narrative, come from people who say that they've entered the sex trade of their own free will or out of curiosity. They say it's a side hustle to supplement their income, to fuel their creative passions, or as a way to express their sex positivity or sexual liberation. In my experience, however, these people represent a negligible minority. But even if it were true that the majority of sex workers are consenting adults, the same buyer who buys that consenting adult is the next day buying a person who is struggling with addiction or facing houselessness or was literally trafficked by legal definition. Some buyers see these vulnerabilities and don't care, and others are actually turned on by them. Buyers aren't stupid, and they sure know how to pick them. If you're a woman who's ever been to a bar, then you know exactly what I'm talking about. You've seen the way that these men treat the most drunk girl at the bar, and if that's just an average college dude, then imagine a man who says that buying sex is his weekly hobby. Now, I've heard Caitlin speak before about respectful, well-behaved buyers. Now, I personally haven't met them, and most of the women in prostitution that I know haven't either. If you spend a few minutes on the hobby boards, which, if you don't know, is like a Yelp for sex buyers, you'll find comments like the following. Quote, she was really strung out, it appeared, and has lost a ton of weight from when we first got together a few years ago. She gives a really good blowjob, but she looks terrible now. Proceed with caution. Or, quote, takes a pounding like a champ across multiple positions. She speaks a decent bit of English, too. Or, quote, her face looks like something you pull out of a dumpster. In the past, I've worked at a free clinic for HIV and AIDS patients. I know all of the body features of an AIDS sufferer. There are her saggy eyes and sunken face, all telltale signs. She's the only one there who offers uncovered everything because she has nothing to lose. These are all comments from New York, where buying sex is illegal, by the way, and they're on the tamer end of what you find on these types of sites. So now imagine a world where men don't have to hide on these sites, where they can buy sex freely with no legal consequences. Well, we don't have to use our imagination, actually, because that's the reality in places like the Netherlands, Germany, Belgium, New Zealand, and several states in Australia. In Germany, for example, where it's legal to pay for sex, a recent study shows that 25% of all German men report having paid for prostitution at least once in their lives, while 4% did so in the past year alone. And because of this high demand, there are mega brothels where you can order a woman off the menu based off of her ethnicity, her breast size, her age, or whether or not she's pregnant. Germany actually shows us that when the human body is subject to the free market, legal brothels advertise gangbangs or all-you-can-fuck offers, excuse my French, where they're for less than 100 euros, men are able to pick as many women as they want. Or what about New Zealand, where paying for sex is not just legal, but decriminalized. A survivor from New Zealand writes, they were 12-hour shifts. The men paid $250. The club took their cut of $150. Then the club charged me a $40 shift fee, a $40 ad fee, and $20 for condoms and lube, making the first booking of the night a freebie, for which I was paid nothing. They ripped the condoms off. They tried to kiss you. They shoved their tongue down your throat. They viciously bite necks and nipples, smack and swear at you. They ask for discounts. They want to do it twice, three times, four times, but they don't want to pay twice, three times, or four times. Now, does any of this not sound like a crime? Is this the free market that we really want to embrace? It's certainly not a system that benefits the worker. All signs point to an arrangement that benefits the buyer. In fact, prostitution was never about women's choice, but always about men's sexual access to poor and marginalized women's bodies. Exploitation is not a bug of this system, it's a feature. The sex trade has deep roots in imperialism, colonialism, and slavery, exploiting Black, brown, and indigenous women and girls. Historically, This sexual violence has been endorsed and even facilitated by our governments, by our militaries. Take the Korean War, for example, where tens of thousands of South Korean women were trafficked into state-sanctioned brothels known as comfort stations from the 1950s to the 1980s to service the U.S. troops that were stationed there. Today, some of those same survivors are suing the U.S. military for the human rights violations they've endured at the hands of the U.S. troops with the full blessing of their government. And let's go even further back. A lot of people who claim sex work is work like to say that it's the oldest profession. But does a system being old make it inherently good or worth defending? The historian Gerda Lerner tells us that prostitution most likely developed in 3rd millennium BC. As slavery became an established institution, slave owners rented out their female slaves as prostitutes, and some masters set up commercial brothels staffed by slaves. And the buyers? They were landowning men, resource-hoarding men, and men with excess income. But instead of breaking the system, Caitlin and others, whether they realize it or not, want to reinforce it and solidify men's access to women and marginalized people's bodies. And this is why we should not romanticize prostitution or sex work. But speaking of romance, Caitlin would say that we oppose buying sex because we as a culture have a problem with sex, that we are prudes or puritanical, or that we want to control women. Some of you may agree with her and feel that there's nothing wrong with wanting to buy sex from someone, or that two consenting adults with equal agency should be free to make their own arrangements. In fact, Caitlin has said, sex that would not be a crime if money were not being exchanged should not become a crime just because someone is getting paid. But that's just it. The payment is the problem. The sex would not be occurring if money were not in the equation. In fact, in most cases, the person being paid would not have sex with you if you did not pay them. When you buy something, you can demand what you want from it because you bought it. Your purchase gives you the control. So in this scenario, once you've opened your wallet, you haven't purchased sex, you've purchased control and power. You know, as we talk about this, I can't help but think of all of the people in my life who have asked me, well, what's the difference between paying for sex or taking a girl out on a date? Or who have said that, you know, we all pay for sex indirectly in some way or another. Which, by the way, is a common mindset on those hobby boards that I mentioned a little while ago. So what is the difference? Well, in dating, all parties involved typically have equal amounts of agency and autonomy over the dynamics of their relationship, even if it's just casual dating. But in prostitution, the presence of money removes the mutuality and introduces a level of entitlement, exposing the self-interest of one party, the buyer. Some like to say that exploitation exists in all industries, that the sex trade is not unique in this, that a waitress can be sexually harassed just like a woman in prostitution can. But a waitress has OSHA to protect her rights. What agency is looking out for women in prostitution? What is the recourse that they can claim for harms that are suffered on the job? Harms like STIs, rectal prolapse, being urinated on, defecated on, having foreign objects inserted into your body, being mutilated and burned. In a study from a group that promotes the legalization of sex buying, even they had to report this staggering statistic. 90% of women in prostitution reported experiencing at least one form of violence committed by sex buyers during a 12-month period. In what other industry does the consumer inflict such sexual, physical, and psychological violence? Okay, I've spent the last 15 minutes or so up here on my soapbox, probably bumming you out, and you're probably eager to hear from my opponent. So as I step away, I just want to leave you with this. Prostitution is a harmful cultural practice that belongs in the dustbin of history alongside child labor, chattel marriage, colonialism, and many other injustices, all of which prostitution is deeply intertwined with. As long as men or anyone can buy access to marginalized bodies, there can be no free or equal society, and this is why I am arguing that paying for sex should be and is a crime. Thank you.
Thank you, Melanie. Thank you, Melanie. Caitlin, 15 minutes for the opposition. Take it away, Caitlin.
My opponent Melanie has dedicated her life to the noble goal of making sure that what happened to her never happens to anyone else. And we share that goal. We both want a safe and healthy society where everyone has access to the resources they need to make choices about their own lives. But arresting people for paying for sex does not help victims. Instead, it makes violence and exploitation within the sex industry more likely and harder to prosecute. Paying for sex is not inherently violent or exploitative. It is paying for a service, like hiring a nanny or someone to clean your home. And paying for advertised services, even intimate or unpleasant ones, is not abuse. But treating service providers cruelly, abusing or coercing them to do things they didn't sign up for is wrong, regardless of what the work is. We live in a deeply racist system informed by colonial forces, and exploitation is rampant across labor sectors. But we cannot support survivors if we are unable or unwilling to distinguish between paying customers and violent criminals. The overwhelming majority of people in commercial sex are consenting adults. And that isn't just based on my experience. You see that in the arrest data. Of the tens of thousands of people who are arrested every year in the United States for prostitution-related offenses, only a small minority, less than 6%, involve trafficking or lead to trafficking charges. In New York City, where there are laws that create compelling incentives and multiple opportunities for defendants to identify themselves as trafficking victims, 80% of people arrested for prostitution don't. I was a sex worker, and the thought that the kind and generous people who respectfully paid for my time would be hunted and put in a cage breaks my heart. Clients help people pay bills, they fund education, they start businesses. These are not predators, these are people. I had a client who was recently widowed, who felt too fragile to date, and he only wanted to be held and cry. And it is a tragedy that this man did not have friends or family that he could turn to, but he didn't. And I am proud that my profession was able to offer him and many people like him a safe place to cry. I met a young man with cerebral palsy in his mid-30s in Detroit. He and his mother traveled from Ohio to see me perform. And the only sexual experiences that this young man has had have been with sex workers. But in Ohio, if he had sent an email to an undercover cop instead of a compassionate professional, he could be charged with a felony. And his mother, who could have been charged too, just for driving him to an appointment. That is what criminalizing sex buyers looks like. Now, my opponent wants you to believe that most clients are monsters, but it's simply not true. Decades of research, including the work of Dr. Barbara Brentz, who is one of the leading scholars on the sex industry, who published the largest comparative study of clients in the US and the UK, shows the opposite. According to the data, most clients are not violent. They are reasonable, normal people seeking connection. And if clients were as monstrous as prohibitionists claim, then people would not keep choosing this work. But consensual adult sex workers exist in large numbers all over the world. We build businesses, we advertise our services, we negotiate with our clients, and we try to take precautions against the risks of our job, many of which are the direct result of criminalization. Going after consenting adults for private behavior not only ruins lives, but it also makes it harder to prevent violence and get victims the support that they need. Criminalization makes it harder to catch predators because people in a criminalized economy don't report suspicious behavior to the police. And black markets are notoriously dangerous, and that's as true of the prohibition of alcohol as it is of sex work. The promise of end demand laws, or of making paying for sex a crime, is that it is a more progressive and compassionate alternative to criminalizing sex work, and that we can and should eliminate an industry that no one wants to live in. But in reality, everywhere that these laws have been implemented, prostitution still exists, and violence within the sex industry gets much, much worse. Think about what it would be like to try to work in a place that was actively trying to eliminate your livelihood, where you had to lie to your landlord and probably your doctor, where you can't seek help from a social worker or the police, where it is illegal to rent to you or for you to have colleagues or share information, and where your customers are jumpy and unwilling to comply with standard industry safety practices because they are the ones who might be arrested. These laws isolate sex workers even when they don't directly criminalize us. Sweden criminalized sex buyers in 1999 in an effort to end demand and eradicate the sex industry. Of course, like abortion, they did not end prostitution. They only made it less safe. Northern Ireland tried the same thing in 2015, and a government report showed that the law had no impact on demand, but it did increase violence against sex workers. In places where paying for sex is a crime, so is renting to a known sex worker. And when social workers or the police find out that somebody is selling sex, they threaten their landlord to get them evicted. Selling sex is considered a form of self-harm in these countries, and good mothers lose their children if they continue. When clients are criminalized, so are the people we work with. Sharing which hotels will let you rent rooms, where to get free condoms, or bad date lists is considered promoting prostitution. And sex workers who work together are charged with pimping. End-demand laws push the entire sex industry underground. These laws not only take away our livelihood, they also undermine the strategies that we use to keep ourselves safe. And when clients fear arrest, they are less likely to share identifying information, to comply with screening efforts, or to communicate clearly. And sex workers have to take risks to appease nervous clients, making it more difficult for us to distinguish between the clients we want and the predators we want to avoid. And despite what prohibitionists would have you believe, there is absolutely a distinction. When paying for sex is a crime, sex workers live in a constant state of terror that they will lose not just their livelihood, but their homes and their children. Sex workers in these countries are not afraid of their clients, they're afraid of their government and the real-life impact of these so-called end-demand laws. Last year, 18 states in the United States increased penalties for buying sex. People are being convicted of felonies just for answering an ad. And law enforcement agencies are investing real time and money, not investigating reported rapes, but in setting up fake ads, pretending to be sex workers, and targeting immigrant-owned businesses, especially Asian massage parlors. The overwhelming majority of people who are arrested for soliciting are poor men of color, because policing prostitution looks like every other kind of policing, and it doesn't look like justice for victims. Mass incarceration is one of our greatest failures as a country, and the U.S. puts more people in cages per capita than any other developed nation. Criminalizing clients will only make this worse, filling our prisons not with rapists and traffickers, but with people entrapped by police posing as sex workers. Incarceration is a necessary evil for violent offenders. But we should not expand the definition of rape to include people like my clients or the many people that I know who treat the sex workers that they hire well. In the U.S., between 12 and 14% of men and 1% of women have paid for sex. That is more than 16 million people and over a million women that my opponent thinks should be locked up. But the tools used to end demand are the tools of surveillance. And when paying for sex is a crime, the police will use their considerable resources, not to support victims of rape or domestic violence, but to track who we pay and who we have sex with and restrict what we can find online. The technology to do this already exists, but giving law enforcement more power to invade our private lives is not feminist or progressive, it's dystopian. But there is a policy that upholds the human rights of sex workers and reduces violence, because when you take an underground industry out of the shadows, health and safety improves. And that isn't just a theory. New Zealand and many states in Australia and Belgium decriminalized sex work And when Rhode Island stopped arresting people for buying or selling sex between 2003 and 2009, STI rates dropped 40%. And violence against women dropped 30%. And when Craigslist erotic services made it easy for sex workers and clients to communicate, the female homicide rate dropped 17%. Because when buying, selling, and facilitating sexual services is not a crime, sex workers are able to find and share information, advocate for their own safety and health, and access the services and support that they need, which is why the World Health Organization, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, the ACLU, and the Freedom Network, which is the largest provider of services to victims of trafficking in the U.S., all support the full decriminalization of sex work, because they know it is the only policy that reduces violence. The data is clear. If the goal is to reduce gendered violence, STIs, and encourage victims to work with law enforcement, then we should decriminalize adult consensual sex work. Sex workers in New Zealand can and do report crimes without fear of arrest. The police in New Zealand do not stalk sex workers looking to arrest their clients. They do not put together elaborate stings to humiliate people. They respond to complaints from victims of domestic violence or assault, and they take those complaints seriously, whether the victim was selling sex or not. Predators exist. We can and should arrest people who prey on sex workers and vulnerable people. But we cannot do that if we keep conflating respectful clients with violent criminals. What we can do is listen to victims when they report crimes. But every dollar we spend arresting consensual adults for engaging in consensual sex work is a dollar not spent pursuing predators. Melody and I both want to live in a society where all people, whether they have ever had sold sex or not, have access to the services and support they need to avoid exploitation. We even support some of the same bills here in New York that would make life better for sex workers and survivors. One of them is an immunity law that would allow people to report crimes without fear of arrest for prostitution-related charges. This is a law that, if signed, will help us catch rapists and traffickers and even serial killers, and it's a common-sense bipartisan bill that has already passed the Assembly and the Senate. It only needs the governor's signature. And Melanie and I both support this bill because laws that help sex workers also help survivors. Sex workers want many of the same things that victims of trafficking want. We want access to resources. We want to be able to report crimes. We want access to healthcare and housing and the banking and technology services that we all use every day, all of which makes it harder for traffickers and abusers to operate. But here's where Melanie and I differ. She and other prohibitionists believe that paying for sex is violence in and of itself, that we can and should use policy to try to eliminate sex work entirely. I believe, as Melanie said, that sex that would not otherwise be a crime should not become a crime just because somebody is getting paid. I have been raped, and I have been paid for sex. Those experiences were profoundly different. Most clients are not violent. But rape and assault exist in and out of the sex industry because sexual violence is everywhere. I was sexually harassed at every restaurant I worked in by customers and managers alike. I have been date raped and abused by boyfriends, and nearly every woman I know, many of whom have never exchanged sex for money, have similar stories. But ending the sex industry, even if it were possible, would not end misogyny or sexual violence. But freeing sex workers to report crimes committed against us, to make and keep our own money, and allowing us to contribute our wisdom and talents to the communities that we're already a part of, might. You don't have to be someone who would ever buy or sell sex to know that people choose to do this work and will continue to do this work whether they or their clients are criminalized or not. We have decades of data that shows that decriminalizing sex work not only reduces violence and STIs, but also creates opportunities for sex workers to hold people accountable who try to hurt us. We can make it easier to report sex crimes. We can prosecute predators and fund real resources for people fleeing violent partners or abusive employers. But we will not do any of that by arresting people for paying for sex. Thank you.
Thank you, Caitlin. 5 minutes of rebuttal from Melanie. You want to take the podium? Take it away, Melanie.
I actually am probably not even going to use my full 5 minutes because my favorite part of these types of talks is getting to the questions so I could actually see what's on the minds of my audience members, or our audience members, if you will. But I just find it kind of amusing when I listen to folks talk about this issue and notice that instead of focusing just on the question or the resolution at hand, there is a conflation, one of your favorite words, of multiple different systems of oppression. And I think that this is a tactic that's used that I want to highlight, because as we know, or as I've mentioned earlier, prostitution as a system is a system that sits at the intersection of many different systems of oppression. I heard you mention, Caitlin, mass incarceration, issues with policing immigrants, and so on and so forth. And Caitlin and I both agree on a lot of that stuff, right? Because oppression across society is terrible in many different forms and facets. However, when we talk about the resolution is paying for sex, if that should be a crime, I think it's important to recognize the role that buyers play. And I think it's interesting to hear, I know you mentioned an example of, I believe you said it was one of your former clients who has in the past paid you to hold them and they wanted to cry. And, you know, I think that's such a sad, loving story. But the reality is that when we're talking about paying for sex, that's not the buyer that we're talking about. We're talking about the people who capitalize and exploit bodily invasion. We're talking about the individuals who are usually and more prevalently repeat offenders, folks who have said that it's okay to open their wallet as many times as they want because they know that they can get whatever sexual act they want. So I think that was just something that I wanted to highlight. You also mentioned disabled buyers, and I've actually heard this argument quite a few times. But I want to remind people that wherever your mind stands on this notion of, you know, well, what about the guy with CP or cerebral palsy? Or what about the guy who lost a foot? Or, you know, quite frankly, what about the man who's just that ugly and can't get it on his own? The reality is, whatever you feel about that, I believe there's somebody for everybody. You may not agree with me, but what we can all agree on is the facts. And sex is not actually a human right. It might be a human desire. It might be a human need, if you will. It is something that I consider natural, but nobody has the right to buy sex. The other interesting fact about disabled individuals is that when it comes to the system of prostitution, disabled buyers or disabled people in general are actually more subject to trafficking and fetishization because of their circumstance, whether that be that they're in a wheelchair because they were hit by a car, or whether they have a mental disability, if you will, or cognitive disability. And it's also important to note that a lot of individuals who are disabled, especially cognitively, are super exploited in the sex trade because they are either nonverbal or don't have the capacity to say no, fight back, speak up, or even say if they like it. They don't have the capacity to do that either. You mentioned a lot about data, and I can't actually cite what study you're referring to in particular, but you did talk about data shows that majority of sex buyers are only seeking connection. And my question would be, what connection and what data? Who is being interviewed? Who is the control group of people that are being interviewed or whatever have you there? You also talked about negotiating with your clients and having that ability. And I want to highlight, yes, this is a divisive issue for a lot of folks. I think sex has been taboo as far as, you know, my lifetime. I'm not that old, but long enough that we all understand that sex is a taboo topic. However, when it comes to negotiations, that is a very privileged viewpoint. And I am not going to sit here and minimize the experiences of anybody who claims that they are a consensual sex worker or sugar baby or OnlyFans model or whatever the hell have you. What I will say, however, is that negotiation of clients does not represent the majority of the people that are in the sex trades experiences. And for those of you who might be in the room who have experiences with the the sex trade that were lucky enough to walk into a room with a buyer and be able to negotiate your own client, I would like to hug you and say congratulations, because you are in what I mentioned earlier as the negligible minority of folks. As I mentioned, statistically, we know that black and brown marginalized individuals are the majority of people who make up those that are purchased in the sex trade. So if Caitlin or any of her counterparts don't reflect that in and of themselves, then how can my opponent stand here and say that the vast majority of people in the sex trade are doing this by free choice? We need to take privilege into account. We need to take the buyer's motivations behind why they're purchasing the sexual access into account. You also mentioned bad client lists, and you know, I hear this from a lot of pro-sex workers a lot, that, you know, oh, well, if we don't decriminalize, it will take away our ability to screen clients. I personally, being in the sex trade myself, have not seen these lists, but I'm sure that they do exist. And to that, I do want to say, how do you know that even if you go on your list with your peers and say, hey, guys, watch out for Mike, how do you know Mike is not going to go in the room and change his tune? You don't. Because the reality is that buyers love power, control, and don't give a shit about consent. And unfortunately, money, when it's in the equation and we're talking about prostitution as a system and not as an individualized choice, then you recognize that the money on the buyer's end is what's actually driving the force. But the reality is that this is not about mutual sexuality or mutual desire for each other. This is about how much can I pay to make you do what I want, even if that's just holding you to cry to sleep. I see the time, so I'll stop there.
Rebuttal from Caitlin. Take it away, Caitlin.
There's a long history of passing restrictive laws in the name of protecting women, but criminalizing alcohol, abortion, prostitution, and obscenity has never prevented domestic violence or protected women from poverty. It has only made their lives and their choices harder. One in three women experience violence at the hands of a partner or family member. We have a real problem with gender-based violence, but it is not prostitution. The first federal anti-prostitution law in the U.S., the Page Act of 1870, was also our first anti-immigration law, and it barred Asian women from immigrating to the U.S. for decades. Years later, in another effort to protect women from white slavery, in 1910, we made it illegal for women to cross state lines for immoral purposes, which was used to crack down on women perceived as promiscuous. And in 1917, we criminalized promiscuity to protect soldiers, which led to tens of thousands of women being rounded up and subjected to horrific and humiliating exams, and dramatically increased the number of incarcerated women. And in the 1970s, well-meaning feminists collaborated with conservatives to ban pornography. And where they succeeded, those same laws were used to ban feminist literature and limit access to information about sexual health, including contraception. Efforts to eradicate prostitution continue to undermine foundational rights for women. And we are not going to get closer to gender equality by policing anybody's sex life harder. Laws suppressing prostitution have been used to restrict women's freedom of movement and target minority communities for hundreds of years, and the Nordic model is no exception. Amnesty International wrote a scathing 2016 report about how these laws are used to target immigrants for evictions and lead to invasive searches and questioning of women of color at the border. And in Sweden, where it is legal for businesses to deny service to Asian women in the name of preventing trafficking. But sex work, in all of its forms, has given people, especially women, opportunities to make money, to leave abusive relationships, and to start businesses. You will not help vulnerable people, especially women, by making it harder for them to make money. But I want to spend the rest of my time talking about what these John Stings actually look like. Because the police say that they are looking for traffickers, but they are arresting people for paying for sex. Some of you may remember when Patriots owner Robert Kraft, a 78-year-old widower, was arrested in 2019 for paying a 47-year-old woman for, according to Mae Zhang's excellent reporting at Vanity Fair, an aggressively consensual handjob. 5 different law enforcement agencies, including the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI, spent months surveilling and investigating 5 Asian-owned massage parlors. The police staged fake bomb threats in order to install hidden cameras in massage rooms, watching hours of footage of people, including women, preparing to receive a massage. They sent in undercover police officers to receive sexual services, and after months, they staged a dramatic sting, humiliating the men and women involved. Many of the women they rescued were deported, and still, the police threw themselves a press conference declaring that they had just broken up an international human trafficking ring. Of course, no trafficking charges were filed, and no evidence of force, fraud, or coercion was found. The only thing unusual about this case is that someone as high profile as Robert Kraft with the resources to fight back was involved. Most people don't. Most people who are arrested for buying sex are poorer, darker, and younger than Robert Kraft. And the most likely people to be arrested are people who have never paid for sex before. Now let's compare that to what trafficking actually looks like, because dozens, maybe hundreds of girls spent years trying to report Jeffrey Epstein's abuse. Jeffrey Epstein was not a client, he was a predator. And he and his collaborators did not try to hire adult consensual sex workers, they were grooming and coercing children, and we were never going to catch him in a John sting. We can only catch predators if we believe victims when they report crimes. We need to shift the conversation away from criminalizing clients like Robert Kraft and more towards stopping predators like Jeffrey Epstein. And we can address violence and exploitation in the sex trade by believing victims, but not by hunting people for paying for sex. Thank you.
Thank you. We now go to the Q&A portion of the evening. I want to inform the people in the balcony, with apologies, we don't have a microphone up there for you. So if you do want to ask a question, please come downstairs and get online. But before we do that, I want to invite either side to ask one question. You can do it now or do it later. Melanie, would you at this point want to ask Caitlin a question? You'll do it later. Caitlin, would you at this point like to ask Melanie a question?
Yeah, Melanie, you've heard me describe the experiences that I've had with clients, and it sounds like everyone that paid to violate you should be arrested. But do you genuinely believe that my clients should be arrested?
I think that when you introduce money into a sexual equation, you contribute to a larger system that, yes, does in fact cause harm for more than just you and a few friends that have lucky clients. So yes, I do think that it should all be criminalized. I think if you want to have sex, it should be based on mutuality, and you don't need money to do that.
Okay. First question, just ask a question as a question, and no need to identify yourself.
You said that the person selling sex can't consent. I have been a sex worker, and quite honestly, I didn't need the money. I did it because I got off on it, straight up. And so I feel like I consented. And so why can't I sell a service with my body that I genuinely can't consent to? Like, I didn't need the money, truly.
You said you have been a sex worker, and why should you? You're basically asking about your clients, though, or no?
No, because there was a point made that I cannot consent because I need the money. Because by me needing the money removes my ability to consent authentically. But if I truly didn't need the money, like, why can't I honestly consent? And why can't I sell that service like a massage?
That's a question for me, correct?
Yes.
Oh, okay, thank you. So quite frankly, first off, I never said that out of my mouth. It's not in any of my remarks. I didn't say that you could not consent. I said that the majority of people that are in the sex trade are there because of an absence of choices. I also said that I was not going to stand up here and minimize the experiences of anybody who claims that they are a consensual sex worker. I did say this. What I am saying, though, is that when we talk about decriminalization or making laws or any approaches to the sex trade at large, we don't legislate or make laws for the minority. minority of people. And quite frankly, when it comes to the numbers, the majority of people that are exploited in the sex industry are done so because they have a lack of choice or they're doing so out of desperation. Others might call it survival sex. Your experience is great for you, but it does not represent the majority of people that are in the sex trade, because not everybody can get lucky enough to say that I consented because I felt like it and I got off on it. That's not the majority of people's experience.
But I can.
You can, sure. I'm not negating that. I'm not minimizing that.
Comment from you, Caitlin, on the question or the answer.
Yeah, I mean, what about people that clean houses or expose themselves to toxic chemicals because they don't have any options? The world is full of desperate people doing desperate things to survive. Why are we isolating sex work as a special example where people suddenly no longer have the cognitive capacity to make choices about their own lives?
Because as you mentioned earlier, it's predicated on gender-based violence. Exposing yourself to toxic chemicals or flipping burgers at McDonald's, yes, can be exploitative in and of itself. But as mentioned, there are protections and agencies that are put into place to ensure that workers have workers' comp, workers' rights, things of that nature, and prostitution does not.
Next question.
Thank you. Good evening. I'm a German. I have...
Forgive me, but I said you did not have to identify yourself. So please strike that from the record, everybody in the audience. You're a human, you're a guy, you look like a guy.
That's the first time I made a joke without even telling it. That's great. Melanie, the question is for you. I'm actually on your side, but I want to tell you that you are that you allowed yourself to be asked the wrong question, and that led you into a trap where you are right now. What you really want to say and discuss is prostitution bad or not? It is similar to, like, is murder bad or not? If murder is bad, then paying somebody to murder somebody is also bad, right? So it boils down to that question, and you are in a trap now. And I want to ask anybody here in the audience...
Excuse me, sir, you didn't even ask a question, but you made a statement.
I'm asking the question
now. And that is sufficient. I think Melanie can comment on what you just said. Thank you very much. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm still trying to follow what you just said.
Well,
but I understand.
Quite frankly,
when it comes to the question of whether prostitution is innately bad or if murdering somebody is innately bad, that's a question on that's based in morality. And as I mentioned in my opening remarks, I'm not here to talk about knee-jerk morality. So we can talk after if you'd like to get my personal opinion on that. But the reality, or rather the perspective that I'm coming from when it comes to the resolution is paying for sex should or should not be a crime, is rooted in personal anecdotes and the statistics and facts that we know around the country.
Okay, excuse me, sir. Sorry. You and Melanie are going to be having a great time talking later. Caitlin, can you comment on the question and the answer?
No, it's just an example. This is just an example of mansplaining. I'm sorry, Melanie. I thank you for being here.
Okay, that's it. All right, next question.
So here's my question. Given the current legal framework and the current prohibition and the incredible prevalence of brothels and trafficking, would you say that the current prohibition system has worked and continuing down that path is a good idea?
I guess it sounds like it's mainly you, Melanie. But I think mainly you should answer, Melanie, first. Go ahead.
I actually do not agree with our current system of full criminalization, and I think Caitlin and I have both expressed numerous occasions that we agree on that. I actually advocate for a different system. I don't want to take too much time getting into that right now, but I do think that there is a third way that has not been explored. I think oftentimes when it comes to this issue, the debate has been either full criminalization or legalization or decriminalization. I do think that there's a way to partially decriminalize the sex trade, and we can talk about that offline if you're interested.
Comment from you, Caitlin.
I disagree. I feel like this is our second debate now where we are going against the, you know, the Nordic model and demand feminist equality and the model of many names, right, where we try to criminalize buyers and facilitators of sex work in an effort to eradicate the sex industry versus the full decriminalization of sex work, which allows buyers, sellers, and facilitators to operate openly, freely, and I believe that that is the only model that reduces violence. So I think that is the conversation that we're having. But yes, Melanie and I both have strong arguments, and we both do not believe that anybody selling sexual services for any reason should be criminalized, which is the current system.
Next question.
Hi, this one's for Melanie. So a phrase that you used that seemed to have some resonance around the
room.
A little
louder, please.
The phrase that you used that seemed to have a little bit of resonance around the room was that sex is not a human right. I heard some nods and such. And I guess my question is, do you believe that something has to be a human right in order to be up for purchase? My understanding is that, you know, there are a lot of things I don't have a right to, just of my own, you know, that I can pay for, you know, like housekeeping came up as an example. So I'm just curious, like, we're not talking about government-issued girlfriends here, right? Like, we're talking about sex as a transaction. Yeah. So I'm just, like, what do you think?
Okay, could you take that question? First, could you summarize the question as you understood it and then answer it?
Sure. The question was, Melanie mentioned that sex is not a human right. And the question is, does something have to be a human right in order to be a service that is legitimately for sale? And so housekeeping was an example. I think, you know, like manicures or spa services, the overwhelming majority of the service industry is made up of things that are not a human right. It's a service that people like.
Comment from you, Melanie.
It is a service that people like. However, prostitution, once again, is the only one that involves an actual human body and not something that's intangible.
Hard to disagree. I mean, like, yeah, people giving me a massage, that's like, there's a lot of intimate care that people provide that 100% involves their bodies.
A lot of massage parlors, especially around New York City, are illicit, and a lot of trafficking and such does occur there. But for those massage parlors that are legitimate, those folks usually have licenses and go through schooling to get that, correct?
Yeah, same thing with people who provide facials or manicurists.
Indeed. Where in prostitution does that exist?
I mean, in the New Zealand...
It doesn't. Okay. Not in New York, not in America, right? Or except for the legalized brothels in Nevada.
So the thing that distinguishes a legitimate from an illegitimate industry is licenses?
No, not necessarily, but here in New York, when we're talking about prostitution being illegal in this state, and I'm using New York only because that's where we are today. I can name other states if you're interested, but when we're talking about whether or not something should be a service, and we're talking about whether or not that should be legitimized because it's not a human right, I'm saying fundamentally, these are not human rights. And I did mention that buying or sex is could be considered a need or a desire by anybody in the room. However, fundamentally, there's no inherent right to have sex, is what I was getting at.
Okay, next question.
My question is for Melanie. Melanie, how do you define sex trafficking? And what do you think the relationship between sex trafficking it is to prostitution and domestic violence?
How do you define sex trafficking?
Yes. So I won't bore you too much with the federal definition, but by federal definition, if you're under 18 and you've been in the sex trade, you're automatically deemed a sex trafficking survivor. And if you are over the age of 18, you have to additionally prove force, fraud, or coercion for it to be deemed trafficking. What I like to say when it comes to sex trafficking versus prostitution, or for other folks in the room, sex trafficking versus sex work, I often say that sex trafficking is the vehicle and prostitution is the destination. So they are inherently related, even if you don't want to conflate them or see the relationship between them. Oftentimes, many people are sex trafficked for the purposes of prostitution, but not everybody that engages in prostitution or sex work has been trafficked. So there is an inherent relationship that, whether you agree with me or disagree with me, cannot be ignored.
Comment from you, Caitlin?
Yeah, I mean, the federal definition of trafficking is, as Melanie said, anyone under the age of 18, or the use of force, fraud, and coercion. And I believe that trafficking, whether it exists in the sex work or any other industry, is wrong and should be aggressively prosecuted. But people can consent to work, and sex work is an example of that.
Next question.
I just wanted to commend both of you just really quickly just about the fact that both of you express some of your traumas within sex work or without. So thanks for doing that. But my question was mostly, sorry.
The latter, go ahead.
My question, Melanie, I thought you made a really great point when it came to control and agency within the sex industry and selling sex. I was curious if you both could speak to kind of like the data points within that. How often is it that a person selling sex might be underprivileged or, like, forgive me for not using the right terminology there, but rather than, like we heard earlier, choosing that route? Curious, kind of like the data points that both of you could bring up in reference to that.
Melanie, could you, when I say as well, could you summarize your understanding of the question and then address it?
Okay, so I think from what I'm hearing, you're asking, what are the data points that we can both bring up that talk about the underprivileged or the types of people? Is that what I'm getting at?
Are you asking what percentage of people in sex work are trafficked?
No. Okay. Percentage of people choosing versus percentage of people that might be kind of more coerced, as you had mentioned, into saying maybe not having as much income or needing to be forced into that line of work.
Do you want me to take that?
Please, yeah, okay. Yeah. It was just for you.
So there's a bunch, and I'm not going to go through all the names right now. There's a bunch from the Department of Justice, the Ministry of Defense, depending on what country or state you're looking at. And I will say, quite frankly, and I'll be fully transparent, I don't like statistics when it comes to prostitution because there are a lot of complex factors, right, when it comes to folks, especially in this industry. A lot of folks are undocumented. A lot of folks are underground. We still have a shit ton of missing and murdered indigenous individuals. So the numbers are not going to always accurately reflect, and I'll be honest with that. However, there are studies both from the also from the United States, from New Zealand, from all of the places that Caitlin mentioned, Germany, Belgium, the Netherlands, Amsterdam. We can keep going and connect with me after so I can get you exact names and ones that have been issued and debunked and ones that are factual and ones that are more recent. But there are plenty of numbers. And unfortunately, when you look across all of the countries and you look at it from that prostitution is that system, as I mentioned, seeing how it's broken down racially and gendered, et cetera, you realize that the majority are black and brown across not only the U.S., but across all of the countries. So we make up that majority, and that's where the numbers are coming from collectively. But I can also break that down for you by country or by state if you're interested in that.
I want to address that, Caitlin.
Sure. I want to echo Melanie's point that it's really difficult to get good statistics about a criminalized class. And so I agree that like statistics are sort of a weird and fuzzy way to do this. But the two that I mentioned in my presentation are that law enforcement that says that they are going after trafficking victims and trying to catch traffickers, they classify less than 6% of people arrested for prostitution-related charges as being trafficking-related or that lead to trafficking charges. The other statistic that I mentioned was that, goodness, I had it in my head just a second ago. A different statistic that I didn't bring up is that according to the Department of Labor, the overwhelming majority of people who are trafficked in the world, 80%, are trafficked into industries outside of the sex industry. Oh, I remember the other statistic. Here in New York, there's a court for victims of trafficking. It's a special court to try to eradicate, I think what we both agree, the egregious harm of like arresting survivors or arresting victims. And so there's multiple opportunities and real incentives for people to identify as trafficking victims. And 80% of the people in New York that are arrested for prostitution-related charges don't identify themselves as trafficking victims.
Next question.
Hello, yeah, this is a question for both. So you both kind of brought up lessons or examples from other countries during your remarks. I'm curious if from those other countries or maybe states, there's been any kind of data research into the wider societal effects of legalizing, criminalizing, paying for sex. So, for example, what effect legalization or criminalization might have on domestic violence, gender-based violence, kind of outside of the sex trade or prostitution, and if there's been any insight into that.
Caitlin, could you just... What's the question as you understood it, and what's your response?
No problem, Gene. So the question is, because other countries have tried different legal models, do we have good stats about the societal effect of either decriminalizing or legalizing sex work? Is that correct? Great. We do. So New Zealand, of course, decriminalized sex work in 2003. Several states in Australia have adopted the policy, and Belgium just became the first country in Europe to decriminalize 2 years ago. And where sex work is decriminalized, not legalized, which means people are sort of forced into brothels, you see a reduction in STIs, you see a reduction in violence within the sex trade, and you also see a reduction in violence against women. There were two stats that came here in the United States. When Craigslist erotic services was widely available in the places where it was widely available, which made it easier for sex workers to connect directly to clients, the female homicide rate dropped 17%. And in Rhode Island, which stopped arresting people for consensual sex work between 2003 and 2009, gonorrhea dropped 40% and reported rapes dropped 30%. So those are the stats that I have off the top of my head. I'm happy to get you more.
Coming from you, Melanie.
Yeah, I agree that there are some numbers out there. I do want to say specifically to the numbers that Caitlin just raised, a lot of these studies that she has mentioned have been debunked. And specifically in New Zealand, when we're talking about Rhode Island with gonorrhea rates going down, and New Zealand also having less homicide rates going down. I do want to mention that in 2003 there was an uptick in rapes that they say they have no understanding of why that uptick happened. But a lot of these studies that came out with these numbers were done right before these upticks. So it appears that the numbers are saying that these things have decreased, but it's going off of a sample size or a population size of a time that was unexplained. But if we actually go 20 years prior to that, when it actually started, then we'll see that those numbers were actually fluctuating the entire time. So we can talk more about that as well.
Next question.
Hi, this one's for Melanie. I want to hear a bit from you about the state of enforcement today and a bit about of enforcement of the current criminalization legislation and how you might think broadly it can be improved or mitigated to reduce negative externalities on sex workers or, you know, folks who others are buying sex from.
I'm sorry, you're asking about enforcement?
Yeah, the current state of enforcement of criminalization legislation and how enforcement itself might be improved to better serve sex workers and better be implemented to serve its intended purpose.
So what kind of enforcement do you want, I guess is the question.
Is that what you're getting at, what kind of enforcement? So I heard you ask about the current state of enforcement. As I mentioned earlier, I don't agree with our full criminalization system. And Caitlin did bring up some of those systems of oppressions that I don't agree with, mass incarceration, things that disproportionately affect black and brown individuals. In terms of trying to make the enforcement system that we currently have better, I think we need to eradicate it and go with a partial decriminalization model, as I mentioned. That would then not only decriminalize, as Caitlin said, we both want the sellers to not be arrested, not only would it decriminalize those who are impacted by the sex trade or the sellers in this particular equation, but it would also, implement, if you will, or increase aftercare services for survivors that have gone through the sex trade, which neither criminalization, legalization, or decriminalization have done. So I am looking towards something known as the equality model or the sex trade Survivors Justice and Equality Act here in New York. That's the kind of enforcement that I'm looking for, a partial decrim model.
Comment on enforcement, Caitlin.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that there are a lot of critiques of our criminal justice system that I think Melanie and I are aligned on. I long for a system that believes people, whether they say that they have been victimized or whether they say they are consensual workers. And when people come forward as victims, I hope for a system that investigates those crimes and offers people support.
Next question.
Melanie, you've mentioned OSHA several times. I have a question. I want to tell you a little bit about myself. I am a forklift driver. I'm a licensed massage therapist. I'm a licensed esthetician. I have been a band manager. You name it. I do eyelash extensions. I kind of just like to get into shit. The only way I would ever have put myself through those trainings is through the money I made through sex work. The only way I would have shared that money and resources with people and continued to get more training is through sex work. OSHA, no matter how many times we're doing things that are not compliant doesn't really do much at all, actually. I'm pending knee surgery that a company is supposed to pay for 4 years. I will have to pay for that out of my own pocket because I have sex work. That is the only way. So my question, Melanie, is if you know that there are these systems in place in legal industries like OSHA, why not push for that type of system to be in place in the sex industry?
Go ahead, Melanie.
Well, quite frankly, if I'm going off of your remarks, you just said OSHA is flawed and that it hasn't helped. So with that, going off of that mindset, right, then we would say that OSHA doesn't work. The point that I was trying to make in my remarks when I brought up OSHA in the first place is that whether or not I agree if they do a good job or not, they exist. Whereas for folks in the sex trade, there are no protections there's no agency, rather, or organization that swears to protect the individuals.
Right. Now, so it's all flawed and we need a system.
Going to your question, the reason why I do not advocate for or want to go for a system that would push for just those protections is because, as I've mentioned in my earlier remarks, prostitution is a very unique system compared to the other systems under capitalism that can be considered exploitative, right? So like I said, flipping burgers at McDonald's can be considered exploitative, but there isn't hierarchy of individuals that... There's a chain of command. I also did want to say, thank you for sharing your personal story. I'm a licensed SD2, so I get it. And again... I hear you, and I get it. And listen, trust me, there every day of my life I think about throwing in the towel, and we all want to make money fast, and I get that, right? But again, like I said, we do not make legislation or approaches to this law for the minority of people. You represent that minority.
I do not.
And you
I
do.
Come join other sex workers and speak to them.
Absolutely.
Because
please.
I am not to the minority. I am not in the minority.
Globally, you are, and that's the point that I'm making. Okay. It's great if you have peers that have similar experiences, but when we look at global numbers, whether the numbers are skewed or not, it still is a very high-leaning imbalance, and I think that's what we need to be talking about.
Comment from you, Caitlin.
Yeah, I mean, you said something earlier that that sex work is unique among exploitation.
Yeah, I was saying earlier, so flipping burgers at McDonald's, I don't know, picking up garbage on the street, all of these other exploitative industries, although exploitative and probably very shitty and probably with very shitty pay, do not have that extent of bodily invasion.
Yeah, this is where we disagree.
We do.
That exploitation is unfortunately ubiquitous, right, for all of the systems that we've talked about. But people... I'm sorry. Hey, I mean, again, my father was a soldier, so you know, I grew up in a system where people are literally sent to their deaths, and he passed away from exposure to Agent Orange. I know people who have suffered multiple miscarriages because they spend their days in nail salons. Right? There are horrible exploitative systems that ruin people's bodies, and I think that we should stand together against all of them instead of trying to focus on eradicating what has become a symbol of exploitation.
Understood. And you know what? Honestly, like we do agree, right? A lot of industries under capitalism are exploitative. I think the difference here is that prostitution is the only one predicated on gender-based violence, the only one that has to do with internal organs, rectal prolapse, things like that don't come from the military unless you were engaging in sexual activity, which is what prostitution is predicated on. Additionally, all of those industries that you just mentioned are necessary for society. Prostitution is not necessary for society, but a military and a capitalist system is.
Next question.
I actually think it's a kind of a
the
timely.
Louder, please.
I think this is actually going to be kind of a timely follow-up question for what you're just talking about right now. A lot, I hear Caitlin saying comparing commercial sex to a lot of different industries, like, you know, doing somebody's nails or cleaning someone's house. So I'm wondering, this is a question kind of more directed at Melanie, are there any like long-term mental, physical, or emotional effects of being continuously bought for sex that might distinguish prostitution from other means of gaining money?
100%. I think even some of the impacts that Caitlin just highlighted from working in a nail salon or cleaning a house can also apply to folks in the sex trade. I don't think that it's extremely different, and I don't think it's extremely specific, but the psychological harms I mentioned, that is lifelong. And I always used to make a joke with other survivors saying, you can take the person out the sex trade, but you can't take the sex trade out of the person. That's because of those mental health effects that last lifelong. We have some of the things that I called out by name, rectal prolapse, vaginal prolapse, STIs is like the bare minimum when we're talking about the things that impact our physical body. Not to mention just other disabilities or being mobily impaired or cognitively, I can't speak today, impaired by some of the things, the physical beatings that you get, not even just from traffickers or pimps or kidnappers, but from the buyers themselves, the threats of harm or death threats that you get from buyers that want extra time but don't want to pay you for it. There are so many examples of how I can display, which I won't do in this minute, but how I can display that prostitution, when viewed as a system and not just an individual's one-on-one choice, how that actually negatively impacts somebody lifelong.
Comment from you, Caitlin.
Yeah, I mean, my father spent the last 2 decades of his life waking up in the middle of the night screaming. I know that PTSD is real, and I know that people that suffer from violent events suffer from it from lifelong. But when I came out to my parents as a sex worker, my mother exclaimed, how could you sell your body? And I said, I didn't. I still have it. And that was my experience.
Next question.
Yes, this question is for Caitlin. I used to work at a youth shelter, 18 plus, for over a decade. And as you probably know, the pimps are outside banging down the door of the youth shelter. They're not looking to kidnap them. They're looking to lure them, pretend to be their boyfriends, and then use a DV situation to traffic them. And a couple years ago, law enforcement said, we're going to stop arresting sex buyers. And those pimps tripled outside the door. So if we were to decriminalize prostitution, as you say, how do we protect vulnerable young people in homeless shelters and places like that?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, thank you. I mean, as I've mentioned before, I think it is so important that we work together to create systems that when victims of violence or exploitation or domestic violence or assault or any of the myriad of things that could happen to anyone in or out of the sex trade come forward, that those complaints are taken seriously. I also think it's important and that we agree that we create systems and structural support so that people coming out of foster care have better options. And in places where sex work is decriminalized, sex workers are less dependent on potentially exploitative third parties because they can post online, they can operate directly. They're not dependent on criminals to help them navigate a criminalized system.
Comment from you, Melanie.
I'm somebody who's a product of the foster care system, so I vehemently disagree with that. And I think that even if sex work, prostitution were decriminalized, the sex trade in and of itself is inherently harmful. So there's no way by decriminalizing all of the laws or safety measures that are currently in place for those in prostitution, even though they're very few, there's no way to ensure that there will be a safer way to engage when you can't predict buyers. That's just how that works.
Thanks. We're running out of time. I'm going to take just two more questions and then there won't be an opportunity to answer them, but you might be able to address them in the summary. Question, please.
Thank you so much. We've heard a number of times this evening discussions about massage parlors and East Asian massage parlors and poor Robert Kraft, who was...
He's fine.
Yes. So by way of background, and you mentioned, Caitlin, the human trafficking intervention courts that arrest people in prostitution and then offer them services and an opportunity to leave. And then the charges are dropped. So I will share that I actually worked in that program for a number of years. The program interviewed thousands of East Asian women who were arrested in prostitution. And as you noted in your remarks, most of them did not report trafficking to law enforcement. And there is a question, as Melanie said, about statistics. I'm going to get to a question, I promise. So the background, what these women disclosed, was that the sex buyers, the trafficking and the abuse, was not inflicted by the brothel managers. It was almost always by the sex buyers. It included stabbing, strangulation, breaking of arms, raping until people were bleeding. And the women did not disclose. So my question is, I understand from both of you the argument that in a world where prostitution, the sale of sex, is decriminalized, those women could go to law enforcement and seek safety. My question is really, how would decriminalizing the purchase of sex, which is the question of the evening, how would that create an environment where this type of behavior would stop? And I'll let both of you answer that question.
It was a good question. I'll have Caitlin, the question is addressed to you. Please comment on it.
Absolutely. The criminalization of sex buying pushes the entire industry further underground, where it gives everyone involved a good reason to fear the police. And in countries that have implemented end demand laws, sex workers do not report feeling more comfortable to go to law enforcement when crimes are committed against them, because social workers, police officers, everyone involved in the system is focused first on getting them to stop selling sex rather than addressing the egregious crimes that you just described. Breaking someone's arm, strangulation, forcible rape, these are all crimes that should be, that absolutely should be reported and aggressively prosecuted. But conflating that with respectfully paying somebody for an advertised service doesn't help victims.
Come in, Melanie.
I just want to know how it's respectful. You say respectfully paying for them. How is it respectful? Is it just this? Simply the exchange of the money is respectful?
Or? I mean, in the same way that I respectfully pay people that do my nails, like, it's, you know, I don't call them names, I don't strangle them, I don't, you know, hold... I mean, we pay for services in this capitalist society.
So the bar
society.
For respect is not strangling you?
Okay, I mean...
No, I mean, that's a legitimate question.
I mean, when I worked as a barista, I dealt with disrespect all day. I mean, like, you know, so there are respectful clients. They exist in every industry, including the sex industry.
All right, final question. Just ask the question, and then the summaries might address it. What's your question?
So if my sister, my daughter, my friend was in a tough economic position, I would encourage them to get a job. And I would say, you might as well just get a service job, become a barista, work in a massage parlor, do housekeeping, cleaning. Just get a job and make some money. I would never, under any circumstances, encourage them, someone dearly beloved in my life, to become a prostitute. So can you try and... So this question is for Caitlin. You use the term sex work, but to me it sounds like a euphemism. Sex work seems fundamentally different from any other kind of work. So why do you continue to use this euphemism? Why is it why do you see it as fundamentally similar and in the same category as other service work? When when Melanie has kind of explained that it's way more dangerous, way more risky, and way more intimate for a woman than any other kind of service work.
Okay, we'll have to allow Caitlin or Melanie to address that question in their summaries if they so choose. We went over time with the Q&A. So with respect to the way Oxycell works, the affirmative gets the first summary. So you have 5 minutes to summarize your position. Take it away, Melanie.
Well, thank you, Jean. That was a lot, right? All right. Well, thanks to Caitlin for engaging in this debate in good faith, and thanks to all of you for, and even those who didn't get a chance, for your thoughtful questions and comments tonight. I am sure that I can speak on behalf of both Caitlin and myself when I say that this is an issue that we think about just about daily, and I think that we both recognize that it's not a topic that the average person engages with or feels like applies to their own life. But even in all the rigmarole, I do hope that tonight I've given you a reason to believe that this issue does impact your life. When society endorses, either through apathy or through legislation, a system based on a hierarchy of vulnerability, it fundamentally changes how we view one another, who we deem valuable, who deserves certain opportunities. I've spoken about all of the ways in which I believe paying for sex is harmful, both on an individual and societal level. Paying for sex violates a human right not to be exploited. It puts prices on human bodies based on gender, race, ethnicity, age, able-bodiedness. It keeps certain groups of people further marginalized and maintains a power imbalance in society. Paying for sex directly fuels the sex trade. People are trafficked because there is a demand for prostitution. When there is a market of buyers, there is a strong financial incentive to supply that market. But there are never enough willing individuals to meet that demand. This is how crimes like human trafficking become exacerbated. I'm asking each of you here tonight to consider the whole system, not just individuals. Harry, for example, buying sex from Sally may not be a violent or harmful experience in either of their minds, but let's look at the bigger picture around them. Harry, buying this consensual sex from Sally, fuels the sex trade in just the same way as Mike buying sex from Molly. But maybe Molly's story is different from Sally's, yet both men's dollars are the same. The more Harrys and Mikes there are, there will be more Sallys, but there will also be more Mollys and Tinas and Marias. It's inevitable that the buyer contributes to a larger system that exploits a population of marginalized people. Just as you might purchase a product from Amazon. You didn't personally cut down the tree or demand that a person work ungodly long hours with little benefits, but you are still contributing to an entity that is destroying the environment and degrading people's quality of life, whether we want to acknowledge that or not. Caitlin and I would probably both agree that we don't live in a utopia, but we disagree on how to navigate our deeply flawed world. And I get it. It's tempting to buy into Caitlin's version of the sex trade, that the prostituted person is merely a worker and that the buyer is simply a client. But I hope I've made clear tonight that the sex trade is anything but a sanitary above-board industry. No amount of regulation or deregulation can fix an industry so deeply wrapped in violence, classism, sexism, racism, misogyny. My opponent likes to say that prostitution is empowering, that it gives women and LGBTQ people, historically oppressed groups, purchasing power and freedom of movement. To that, I'd like to quote a writer and an academic known as Julia O'Connor Davidson, who writes the following. Some analysts move to talk about the selling of sexual labor as though it can represent a form of resistance to inequalities. Yet few would, for example, describe the sweatshop worker as challenging poverty by stitching garments, or the airline flight attendant as defying sexism by smilingly serving drinks, or the black child in the Caribbean as resisting racism by polishing the shoes of white tourists. Paying for sex should be a crime because it is a crime. No one is entitled to sex. And even though many of us in the room enjoy it, it is not a human right. But what everyone is entitled to is the right to freedom, equality, dignity, and safety. This country has a very long history of commodifying human beings, the most vulnerable and marginalized among us, particularly black, brown, and indigenous women and girls. And I'm sorry, but I will not support any policy that packages up this commodification as empowerment or as a way out of poverty. My vision for the world is simple. I want everyone's sexual experiences to be rooted in reciprocity, mutuality, and respect. And I want to be clear here. There's absolutely nothing wrong with wanting sex or having it, even if it's just casual. But when you pay for sex, that money manufactures a willing participant and the illusion of desire. The presence of money summons up the presence of a person who only tolerates sex with you because of that money. You cannot commodify sex without commodifying another human being. You cannot separate the two. And look, I'm not here to infringe on anyone's freedoms or privacy or personal sex life. However, the survivor in me is asking you all to go beyond the easy narrative of the two consenting adults. If we tolerate the sexual exploitation of even one person in the name of protecting personal freedoms, then we are saying exploitation itself is acceptable. I know I don't want to live in a society like that, and I hope you don't either. Thank you.
Five minutes of rebuttal from Caitlin. 5 minutes of summary from Caitlin. Take it away, Caitlin.
Melanie and I agree on a lot. We both believe that no one should be forced to sell sex against their will, and that people who sell sexual services should not be arrested regardless of why they are doing this work. We both believe that domestic violence and trafficking are real problems, and we support efforts to make it easier for people to leave abusive relationships and employers. And we both want to hold predators accountable. We share a genuine desire to reduce the vulnerabilities and violence inflicted on people in prostitution, but we disagree on how to do that. I want to increase access to services. I want to make it easier for people to report crimes and to share information with each other. And Melanie wants to arrest people for giving sex workers money. There are absolutely people who have had sex for reasons that are more complicated and harrowing than mine. But if you hate people doing gross stuff for money, then what you hate is poverty and not prostitution. Attempting to eradicate prostitution by criminalizing clients or the people we work with will do nothing to alleviate the very real conditions of extreme poverty, gender-based violence, or exploitation that exist, not just in sex work, but across labor sectors. I do not want to prevent consensual sex between adults or make it harder for people to give each other money. And I know that it is never okay to trick or force anyone to work or to have sex against their will, but we cannot arrest our way out of poverty. And you will not improve the lives of desperate people, especially women, by making it harder for them to make money. Making it harder to buy sex does not address any of the needs of desperate people doing desperate things to survive. We can and should pursue policies that make it harder to take advantage of vulnerable people in and out of the sex trade. In 2021, the Government of Accountability Office issued a report concluding that the shuttering of Backpage, which was heralded as a victory for victims of prostitution, actually made it more difficult for law enforcement officers to identify or track cases of exploitation. Places like Backpage and Craigslist Erotic Services and platforms that sex workers use to directly connect with their clients and share information with each other make sex work safer. And shuttering that and pushing the industry further underground makes it more dangerous. No one is more interested in reducing violence and exploitation within the sex industry than sex workers themselves. But people who pay for sex are not synonymous with the people who prey on sex workers. I have done a variety of different kinds of sex work, and I know that it is not for everyone. I could never work in a slaughterhouse, for example, and I was a terrible waitress, but I enjoy doing sex work, and I am not alone. Everyone has their own boundaries, but just because I could never imagine myself working at a slaughterhouse doesn't mean that we should outlaw meat processing. I do think that we should work for more labor protections for everyone, including people that work in agriculture, domestic labor, and textiles, which is where the overwhelming majority of people who are trafficked occurred. I have had some great clients, and I have had some hard clients, but I would sooner go back to sex work than to waiting tables. Yeah. Where the customers are more annoying, and I had fewer options for addressing their behavior or enforcing my boundaries. Exploitation is wrong across labor sectors, and forcing someone to work in a slaughterhouse or a factory is just as wrong as forcing someone to work in a brothel. But so long as we continue to conflate erotic labor with exploitation, we're going to keep going after the wrong people and hurting the very people we want to help. There are real problems with trafficking and exploitation and gendered violence in and out of the sex industry, but we cannot address any of them if we continue to conflate paying someone for advertised sexual services with criminal violence. We will not address any of the very real harms that Melanie and I both agree on by arresting people just for paying for sex. Thank you.
All right, Lucas, please open the final vote. Yes, no, or undecided. Paying for sex should be a crime. I want to bring my friend Heckman to the stage for a moment. We at the Soul Forum were planning a debate on the mayoral race in New York City, and it turns out that Heckman, who runs a copycat debate society modeled after the Soul Forum, is scheduling such a debate. So, Heckmet, explain what you plan.
Thank you, Gene. I describe myself as an acolyte of the great Gene Epstein. And
thank you, Heckmet. Yeah.
As his acolyte, we started a sister debate society that is also Oxford style. And this September 23rd at 7:30 p.m. in the Soho Playhouse in Soho, we will have a debate on Zohran Mamdani. The resolution reads, New York mayoral candidate Zohran Mamdani's political program is radical by mainstream measure. And the debaters will be Ross Barkan from NYC Mag and Daniel Itfraini, who's the Fox News contributor. You can find the tickets at joinyv.org, or you can come find me after this debate or at Gene's apartment later tonight.
Thank you, Heckmet. I myself plan to attend that debate on, what is it, September 23rd? September 23rd, at the Soho Playhouse. I hope you're still voting on the resolution, yes, no, or undecided. While you're voting, let me announce that, of course, the Soho Forum has a debate, a live debate, every month of the year. Our next debate will be Tuesday, October 21st, and that resolution will read, the failure of Oregon's experiment in decriminalizing all drugs is compelling evidence that other attempts at complete decriminalization will fail just as badly. For the affirmative, defending that resolution will be Kevin Sabat, a former White House Office of Drug Counsel Policy advisor to three presidents. Opposing the resolution will be Zach Weissmuller, Reason senior producer and host of the Reason podcast, Just Asking Questions. Again, I want to urge all of you who have a ticket to come to the after party. Both Melanie and Caitlin will be there for further discussion, further exploration of the issues to the extent that you would like to explore them. Great food, great drink as well. Where do we stand, Lucas, on the moment? Yeah, we're still voting? Okay, votes are still coming in. Oh, you're... Oh, 1 minute, okay. Okay. In November, what the heck is so funny? Okay. On November 19th, we had to reschedule it November 19th, and ironically, that's my birthday. We're planning our next debate on November 19th, and there will be a cake with 81 candles on it in my honor at that debate. And it will be about affirmative action. The debate resolution will read, is the U.S. Supreme... Statement. The U.S. Supreme Court of 2023 decision to dismantle affirmative action in American higher education marked a significant regression in the pursuit of racial equality. Defending that resolution will be Princeton University Professor Paul Frymer. Opposed will be Jason Riley, Wall Street Journal opinion columnist and author of The Affirmative Action Myth, Why Blacks Don't Need Racial Preferences to Succeed. And Lucas, we're still... Oops, okay. I have in my hand... I'm about to have in my hand the Soho Forum Tootsie Roll that goes to the Oxford Style winner of this debate. And the yes vote went from 24 to 47, picked up 22 points. That's the number to beat. The no vote lost a couple of points. So therefore, the Tootsie Roll goes to Melanie Thompson. Please. Congratulations to you both for a stimulating exchange. Both of you are coming to the 55 Great Jones Street. A lot of people know where it is, so just follow the crowd or follow me on my cane, even though I walk like a cripple.